Freilich in Purim, Rabbi Chaim Bravender, teaching Megillat Esther.
Something about Megillat Esther. Tonight is Purim. For those of you who are not checking your calendars daily, and it is known as Esther, but for those of us who live in Yerushalayim, it's not Raya Bria that tonight is Purim. Okay. But in understanding Megillas Esther, and I try to understand the meaning of the story of the Megillah. We're just talking about the story. And the story of Megillas Esther can be learned in different ways. One way that I would suggest, one way is to look at the personalities in Megillas Esther, and we'll see, if you look at the personalities, you'll see that for each personality there's a story. There's a story of Mordechai, the story of Esther, the story of Ahasuerus, the story of Haman, Vashti, etc. Each of these personalities, each of the personalities seems to have meaning beyond the story itself, and implications which are more general than the story of the Megillah. If we would ask ourselves, who's the hero of Megillas Esther? Or who's the central, whose character does the Megillah focus upon more than any other? So my answer to that question would be Mordechai. So in spite of the fact that Esther was sort of the point man, point woman in the story, and she did things without which the Jewish people would not have been saved, or at least, one can never say that, but the way that the Jewish people were saved in the story of Megillas Esther was through the intervention of Esther. However, Mordechai was the one who seemed to know and to understand and to be directing. But there's another aspect to the story of Megillas Esther as it applies to Mordechai that I'd like to point out. If you remember how the Megillah is arranged, right? The Megillah has 9 plakim and a 10th part, which is just a few psukim, and tells the story of in chronological order, right? The beginning at the beginning, and the middle at the middle, and the end at the end, which is what's called chronological order. One of the chapters of Megillat Esther, however, of the Megillah, is different than the others. And that's the 6th chapter of Megillat Esther, the chapter that begins with the words Balayahu Nadidor Shinas HaMelech. And it tells a story, this 6th chapter alone tells a story within the story. And it's not a story that relates necessarily to the broader story of Megillas Esther, which is about the difficulties that the Jewish people had and how they were saved. But there's a story within the story. And the story within the story begins with the king, Ahasuerus, being unable to sleep. And he says in that first passage, it says, he the king said, and this is all a kind of a fortuitous thing, and we don't know. Chazal comment on whether the Nevedash Nas HaMelech, whether there are indications that this was actually obviously Min HaShemayim, that Kodesh Baruch created the need that the Ahasuerus had, this inability to go to sleep. And it's also not clear why he said, is this something that was common? Is this what he did whenever he had insomnia? I mean, was this great intellectual that the only way he could ever go to sleep was with someone reads a book to him? But But that's not the way the story turns out. He doesn't go to sleep. He brings the sefer Zichronos Divayamim. And they read about Mordechai, who saved the king from Biklan the Teresh, and is not rewarded. So in this odd, there's an odd sequence, right, in the story. All of a sudden, Haman is there, and he's outside, and the king calls him in and says to Haman, what should we do? And Haman says, you know, Haman says, it must be me. It must be me. The king is not telling him, it must be me. And what does Haman want? And what does Haman want more than anything else in the world? He wants to be the king. What is Haman? What is Haman? He's the Mishnah Melech. Because Haman did not simply have a position of authority, but we know that the story of the Megillah, at least on the micro level, is about Mordechai not bowing down to Haman. And Haman, therefore, since everybody was instructed to bow down to Haman, Haman was the king. I mean, he was not the king of kings of Persia. That was Ahasuerus. But he was also a king, not simply a powerful personality who had the ear of the king, but he was a person to whom everybody was obliged to bow down. So Haman was king number two in Persia. What did Haman want to do? What did he want? He wanted to be king number one. Not only did he want to be king number one, but he's not embarrassed to at least mention it by implication. Now, oddly enough, Ahasuerus, who hears this from the mouth of Haman, this business about let's dress him up in the clothes of the king and let him ride on the horse of the king, and suddenly you walk around in town and say, "Kachi Yasalus," this is what the king does if he wants to truly honor somebody. So you think that the king would be a little embarrassed or insulted or see or smell that there's some kind of an undertone of opposition here? I mean, if you go to the king and you say, and the king says, "Well, what would you like me to give you?" And you say to him, "No, how about your job?" So that would sound like, you know, a revolt. I mean, not the kind of thing that kings take well to. But in this case, the king said, "Oh, it's a great idea. It's a great idea." And here, of course, you know, everything in the Megillah has to be understood. And it could be that the king is looking at Haman and saying, you know, it's a great idea. I know what you think. Let's do it to Mordechai, which is sort of like saying to Haman, David, I know what you want. You're not going to get what you want. But somebody else is going to get what you want, which is even worse than Haman not getting what he wants. And that's the end of the story. That's the end of the story, that chapter. And then Haman goes home to his wife, and his wife says, you know, as wives are wont to do at times, and says, "Yeah, you've had it, Haman. This is bad." Haman was a supportive wife, Haman was the second to the king. But you know, his wife told him that he was just down the fool. There's the story of the sixth chapter. Now, in this story, the sixth chapter, you read the Megillah, you know, you have a little kind of literary sense. So you say, well, what is the story about? Well, what is the story of the sixth chapter of the Megillah? Well, obviously, it's a kind of a precis. It's what's going to happen. It's like the Megillah stops, and the Megillah says, well, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. I know you're nervous now. I mean, this is like a tense moment in the story. Esther invited Haman and Ahasuerus to come and eat dinner with her, and you don't know how that's going to turn out. You don't know how Esther's going to solve the problem. So here comes the sixth chapter. The sixth chapter says, well, don't worry, it's all going to be all right. It's a kind of a marshal that, you know, Mordechai will be up and Haman will be down, or Haman will be up on the gallows and Mordechai will be up on the horse, and so you can relax. Even though it's going to take you to get 7, 8, 9, and a little bit of 10, it's going to take another 3 chapters for the Megillah to work it all out and tell you how it is going to happen, that the Jews are going to win and that the Hamanites are going to lose. But at the end of chapter 1, you already feel relaxed. Like, we know that everything's going to be all right, because if you're Mordechai has already been on the horse. And therefore, you might say that the point of the sixth chapter of Megillat Esther is a kind of a variant. in the middle of the story, they're just at this tense moment, along comes chapter 12 and says, don't worry. But that the chapter itself is not reflective of the issues of Megillat Esther. Because the issues of Megillat Esther are the Jewish people and anti-Semitism and Haman and whether the good guys are going to win and the bad guys are going to win. Those are the issues. But the issue is not whether Mordechai is going to be riding a horse at the end of the day. But this is not the case. Because if you look further in the Megillah, in the 9th chapter and the 10th chapter, you'll see that this is precisely the issue. And that what happens at the end of the story, Megillat Esther, is nothing more or less than the fact that Mordechai becomes the king of Persia. And that the way the story is told, if you look carefully at the Pesukim, you'll see that this is certainly the real intention. And that what Haman did was a ruse. It was simply a way that the Hashgacha, that the divine control, organized the Malchus of Mordechai. And this is summarized in that 10th chapter, which contains three psukim. The first pasuk in the 10th chapter is about Achashverosh. Vayasel amel Achashverosh masel ha'olz v'yayah. So that the last pasuk that talks about Achashverosh, which is the first pasuk in the 10th parak, says that Achashverosh taxed all of the nations. Of course, this is in contradistinction to the beginning of the Megillah. When the kingship of Achashverosh was in doubt, and in order to solidify that kingship, you had to invite representatives of the 127 Midianites, right? And those representatives, by coming together to this party, indicated their allegiance to Achashverosh. And then you have the story of Vashti, and Vashti chose that occasion to indicate her position, which was not exactly in line with that of Achashverosh. And the last thing that Achashverosh did was to place a tax on all the nations. Now, taxes do different things, as you know. Because you're Americans, Americans there, they talk a lot about taxes. Not like in Israel, where you just pay taxes. But in America, they talk a lot about taxes, and there are always people who understand, you know, there's always this problem, like, why are there taxes? So one reason that you tax people is to make money. But even if you don't want to make money, or if you don't have to make money, or the people that you're taxing don't have any money, taxing them has other benefits, because it establishes a relationship, right? The relationship between the guy who's collecting the taxes and the guy who's paying the taxes, even if he's not paying anything, their relationship is very clear. Like, if you have to go to the tax guy and explain to him why you don't have to pay any taxes, so you have a very clear relationship. So that the kingship of Achashverosh is based on this ability to collect taxes. So the first pasuk at the end of the Megillah is that Achashverosh became king. That from the Achashverosh, we're not talking about this today, but you understand that from Achashverosh's point of view, the story of Megillas Esther is about Achashverosh. It's about him solidifying control of 127 Medinot and all the ups and downs along the way. Like Esther is part of that story, Vashti is part of the story, Bigtan Matosh is part of that story, and Haman is part of the story, and Mordechai is part of the story. They're all part of the story of the Jewish people, or part of the story of Achashverosh solidifying his control. And this last pasuk is a pasuk about control. Then the second pasuk called Asay Takvev V'Asay Parashas V'Diras Mordechai. The second pasuk says the great things that Achashverosh did, especially to Diras Mordechai. Asher Gidlei Melech Alohim Ksuvi Asay Divrei Yamin Malchei Mered Medayi Peras. They're all written on this, you know, in these books of Divrei Yamin that you have come into contact with Balayla Haru. Right, Balayla Haru, Achashverosh wrote from these books. Tim Mordechai Yehudi Mishnah Lamech Achashverosh Yedera Yehudi Yatsuri Erecha. So in fact, Mordechai Yehudi was Mishnah Lamech Achashverosh. He became the associate to the king. He was the second Jew in history to be the associate to the king. And that, you know, the first was Yosef, and now is Mordechai. A full example of the same type of personality, although his exact relationship with the king is unclear as who? No, Nechemya. But you got the right idea. Nechemiah was more like a Rex Nascara. Right? He was like a young guy who was imported from a foreign country because he was smart. Right? Whereas, but it wasn't clear that he had power. It wasn't clear that Daniel had power. Nechemiah, on the other hand, had power, which he used in order to help out the Jews in Yerushalayim. Right? But it's not clear what Nechemiah's position in the court of the king was. I mean, that's not so clear. But he went back, and it was a real position. So these are the examples of that he's not called Mishneh HaMelech. I mean, Mordechai is called Mishneh HaMelech. In this pasuk, since we've read it, I just want you to know that there is this odd sequence. Right? Gadol HaYehudim, he was great amongst the Jews, which sounds positive. Ratzur Lev Echav, we'll leave that for a minute. Deresh Tov La'amev, Deresh Shalom, Mekol Zero. Tov and Shalom, you know, Tov and Shalom are big words in Jewish intellectual history, right? Jews are interested in Tov, and leads in Shalom. These are the best words, right? So if Mordechai could be the guy who brings Tov into the world and brings Shalom into the world, it's like saying Mordechai is the greatest, right? Not only the greatest because he was the king, but he was the greatest Jew that you could imagine because he was doing Tov and Shalom. But this other phrase, Ratzur Lev Echav, is a problematic phrase, that he was accepted by the majority of his brethren. And Chazal have indicated, and it appears in the Medrash and Esther Rabbah and the Gemara and Megillah, and Rashi quotes it in the Megillah, there's Lev Echav. I mean, what's the point of saying that there was a minority of Jews that thought that there was something wrong with Mordechai? There was really Mordechai. So the Gemara says, and Rashi quotes, the Lev Echav, So Mordechai is actually accused that it's the last Rashi, or next to the last Rashi in the Megillah, next to the last Rashi in the Megillah. Imagine that, here's Mordechai, the story of Mordechai. Mordechai who saved the Jewish people, Mordechai who directed Esther. I would have to go, if you look at the Gemara and the Ramachan, who's married with Anshe Knesset Gedolah, Mordechai, Tamim Mehirim, who was in the same Chaburah as the prophets and the Rabbanim. And the last thing that you say about Mordechai in the Megillah is that after he became king, he wasn't learning so much. He was brought up in Talmudah. And of course he was brought up in Talmudah. Why do you think that to be king doesn't take any time? I mean, why would you say a thing like that? It's like saying, you know, if you have a doctor, I think you understand. I mean, I feel like if you have a doctor who sits and learns every day for 3 hours, what do you say? Oh, if he wasn't a doctor, he could live for 12 hours a day. I don't think people wouldn't say that. And here's Mordechai, he became the king of Persia because he had to save the Jewish people, not because he was looking for work. And he was brought to the Talmudah, it's because he was saving the Jewish people. I mean, there are times when even the mitzvah Talmud Torah has to be put off, and certainly this would be one of those times. I imagine that, to my mind, the Chazal are talking about, I mean, the only way I can understand this Chazal is by connecting it to the overriding tension that exists between Malchus and Torah. And this is a tension that you know about from the Chumash and from the interaction between Shmuel HaNevi and the Jewish people who wanted to have a king, which led the Bible now in the famous commentary in Shmuel to point out that actually there is no mitzvah to have a king in Israel. It's kind of optional. It's something that you could have and you could not have. And this against the Rambam, you know, the Rambam says that it's a mitzvah to have a king. The Rambam has said, no, it's clear that there is no such mitzvah, and that it's only an optional. It's a question of a political position. And if you learn the Tosefta, because of the Mishnah Tosefta, we have not raised the Tosefta in Sota, you'd see that great pains are taken, at least Chazal understood, it was necessary to place the king in a situation where his connection to the Torah is so overwhelming that he could never tear himself apart. He couldn't separate himself from the Torah. He had to carry around the Torah with him. He has to write a Sefer Torah. He has to look at the Sefer Torah. I the things that the scriptures are really hard to imagine as some of them on a practical level. But in other words, I think that what this Rashi may mean is not that Mordechai was mevatel Torah because he had to be a king. I mean, obviously he did that. But it's somehow in this tension that must exist between Malchus and Torah, there was some sort of criticism of Mordechai. That's how Chazal are explaining that Mordechai, being king in Israel, or being king in Persia, affected in some way, which is not clear to us at all, his devotion to the Torah. And Chazal leave it at that. They don't explain it anymore, but I mean, what I wanted to say was that I think it's simply a question of time. But Chazal said they criticized Mordechai because he didn't have as much time to learn as he had before he was a king in Persia, because that's quite obvious. So the point that I tried to make up to now, the first point that I tried to make is that Mordechai is the central character of Megillas Esther, and what happens to Mordechai, the story of Mordechai, is not the story of the clever Jew who outwits the anti-Semitic Haman and Ahasuerus, who's a little bit of a mar. That's not what Mordechai is. But Mordechai is the man who marches through history to become a king. And it's interesting that the last thing that said about Mordechai and his kingship is critical. There's some problem with the kingship that Mordechai evidences. And therefore, the story of the sixth part of the Bias Esther about Mordechai on the horse, and Mordechai with the clothes, and Mordechai with the Haman saying, Kachi Yasala Ish, that's the main part of the story. That's what's really happening in the Bias Esther. And all the rest of it is just about the Jewish people being saved. And the Jewish people, of course, are going to be saved because they're the ones who have accepted the Torah Mithinai, and then I could have been saved them in an obvious way or a less obvious way. We are pretty confident that the Jewish people are going to be saved. But we were not confident before this time. We didn't have any understanding of the fact that Mordechai would have to become king in order for this to actually take place. So, this is my contention. The most important thing that happened is that Mordechai became king. The second thing I would like to mention is that there are several mitzvot that result from the Chag of Purim. Like the Seuda, Kriyas Megillah, Halal, as you know, there's some kind of connection between them. Matanos of Yonim, which are very makpid on Purim, like Matanos of Yonim are makpid to try to give the money to a real Evyon, to a Halachic Evyon. Like usually what during the year, if somebody sticks out their head and asks if it's stucker, so do you beat stucker? I mean, if a person, then ask them if how much money do you have in the bank? I mean, if a person is willing to demean himself, or has a lot of money, willing to demean himself in this way, so we don't demean in favor by trying to investigate. But on Purim, my parents love Yonim, you need an Evyon. We're very knocked about that. So now the mitzvah, so I have the mitzvah of Suda. And there's one mitzvah that I've left out, right? Right, Mishloach Melos Ishtiyah. Now remember, Mishloach Melos Ishtiyah is a sort of an odd, not sort of, but it's an odd mitzvah. Because it's, I give people food who have food. Right? I give people food who have food. It's an annoyance. It's an annoyance for the giver, and it's often a bigger annoyance for the receiver. Right? Those of you who are married and have gone through this experience know what I'm talking about. And don't realize we have tricks, you know, the famous Gishas Menas, the very esoteric types of things, you know, like the vacans of esoteric mushrooms or bottles of esoteric wine, to make sure that you can test to see if the people you give it to then take the stuff and give it to somebody else. Whereas if you just said regular stuff, so you assume it's all like, you know, being this way, if you buy esoteric kind, then you can. In America, the Chalal, they now have Mishloach Menos is computerized. I think, you know, you're giving the name to some central computer on the internet and plus a check. And somehow everybody gets a worthy amount of Shalach Menos. I don't know exactly, you know, how that works, but I guess it's less than more. When you get a note saying the Shalach Menos have been contributed on your behalf to somebody else. Or, you know, America is very into using technology for mitzvah purposes. And so I guess this is what I think. But you have to recognize why the Shalach Menos is not a mitzvah. I mean, if you're going to see this, you invite somebody, come over to my Suda, let's have a Suda go, let's go very nice. But why would you want to send somebody a little bottle of wine and some apples or something? Why would you want to buy big bags of candy and then divide them up into little bags? What is this? You know, what is this mitzvah of Mishnah? Well, I don't know where does it come from. I know where it comes from. But what is it supposed to accomplish? Also, what exactly is it? Is it supposed to? You know, what is it supposed to accomplish? Well, that's the problem of Mishloach Menos. The third thing that I would like to mention is again at the beginning of the sixth parak of the Megillas Esther. It says, "Balayla hima nidoshnas amarecho yedus pesuk." Balayla hima seifis echoreski v'ya migli kroim v'fnei ma. There's a literary problem, a language problem. The book that they brought to the king is called Sefer Zichronos Divrei Hayamim. Now the word Sefer Zichronos Divrei Hayamim mean exactly the same thing. That is to say, in as far as I know what either of them mean, they mean the same thing to me. Now Divrei Hayamim is a kind of historical account of what happened to the king, what happened in the court. Sefer Zichronot is a book of remembrances, which is exactly the same thing. Sefer Zichronot is very Hayamim. Now, why would the Megillah have to explain itself? Why would say Sefer Zichronot, that is to say Divrei Hayamim? There is this construct in Megillas Esther. You know, Megillas Esther says, "He killed Pur," that's the continuation, "Hu HaGoyal." That says that Pur is a Goyal. But you know that Pur is a Persian word. The word Pur is a Persian word, and when they wrote the Megillah, I guess they realized that not everyone knows Yisrael would know what a Pur is. So he killed Pur, Hu HaGoyal, means Haman, he threw lots, which we call in Persia a Pur, but as you might know elsewhere as being a Goyal. Which I guess makes sense. I mean, you could say to me, well, why should we go out to do it? Why would we go just right to Pur Goyal? Yes, but then we would have no reason to call the holiday Pur. We'd have to call it Goyalim, which I guess was not as attractive an option to Mordechai and to Esther. But he did Pur Goyal, at least the Megillah is explaining a word that I don't understand. But say this is Chorez Goyalim, it sounds like exactly the same thing. Furthermore, if you look at the end of the second parak, at the second parak of the Megillas Esther, where is the second parak? The end of the second parak of the Megillas Esther is the story of Bigtzah v'Seresh, right? You know, Mordechai was sitting around and he was listening, and he had finished an advanced degree in the languages of the world, and he knew all the languages. And so he's sitting there, big time the Torah was talking, I guess, Armenian or something, and they knew that no one understood, but Mordechai did understand. And then he told Esther, told the Chashverosh, and they were killed. Well, that's the story. The last person in the second book says, where you caution the veil, where you not say, where you tell Yishnei, where you eat, where you can say. Did you know that Megillas Esther, those of you who are into Ulpan, so you know that there are passive binyanim, there are active binyanim, and passive binyanim. In modern Hebrew, the passive binyanim passed away. and they are more passive than you can imagine. But in Megillas Esther, the passive forms, sometimes they just all kind of come together. Everything's passive. Look at this passage. See, Vayivada, Vayivakash, Vayimatzei, Vayitomu, Vayikosei. Wow. Right? So that's, you know, I don't know why that is, but it's noteworthy. Noteworthy is the start of learning, right? If you note something, then you can think about it. If you don't, anyway, it says here that you can save the Sefer Devar Yamim of Noam Noach. That's what it says. Where is the story written? It is written in the book called Devar Hayamim. It's not called Sefer Zichron Notes. Just Devar Yamim. And you saw the last pasuk in Parag Yud. Again, when they write about all the things that Achashverosh did and Mordechai did, it says that Halang Suvir Sefer Devar Yamim Minachim Ve'ad Medar Peras Sefer Devar Yamim, but there's no mention of Zichronos. There's just Devar Yamim. Devar Yamim, but no Zichronos. So the question is, in the beginning of Parag Yud, when the king says, "Bring me that book." Why do we say, bring me the Divrei Hayamim? Why do we say, bring me Divrei Hayamim and Sefer HaZichronos? What's the point of Sefer HaZichronos? But you know that after the Milchama with Amalek, and in the war with Amalek, there's an interesting war. It was an attempt to show that a war could be fought, and that the people fighting the war, who at the time that they're fighting, at that very moment, can maintain a spiritual dimension. And so when Moshe Rabbeinu raised his arms and people looked up to heaven, even though looking up to heaven may not be the thing to do when you're fighting the war of confrontation, you should probably look at the people who are coming to kill you. Nevertheless, within that context, Moshe was able to be victorious. And when they stopped looking down towards heaven, they couldn't win, so that the spiritual component of the war that was fought against Amalek, interestingly enough, it wasn't that they set the hand before the war, it was that they set the hand after the war, or that they thought about God before or after, but during, mamash, while it's going on, they had to focus on God. And of course, anybody who's ever been involved in something like a war understands that this is a difficult, if not unreasonable, proposition. After the war with Amalek, there's a special tzivri that a Kadosh Baruch Hu gives Moshe Rabbeinu, which is that Yom Hashem and Moshe Ksov Zos Zikaron B'Sefer Yisim Be'ezna Yeshua Ki Mocha Emcha Ezecha Amalek V'Tarez HaShemayim. There's a special tzivri to write the story of the war in the Sefer, to write it as a Zikaron the Sefer. A Zikaron the Sefer. Now what Sefer it is in Machlokes Rishonim, that's not our issue right now. But what is this term Zikaron the Sefer? Isn't it true that anything you write in a Sefer is a Zikaron? Anything you write down is remembered better than not writing it down? What is this Zikaron? What is this this idea of writing it as a Zikaron? One last source is the last halacha of his Megillah. The last halacha of his Megillah, which is Megillah comes from a Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi is quoted by the Rambam of Agos Mahamunias at the beginning of the Yerushalmi in Megillah. Now, of course, you understand that the reason we look at things in the Rambam, right, is because the Gemara is much more a collection of diverse material. And in the Gemara, you have halacha, and you have stories, and you have agadata, what's called agadata. And it's not jarring if in the Gemara we find things that are not exactly halachic. Because we know, chatchila, that the Gemara is a collection of different kinds of material. However, the Rambam, in his book called Mishneh Torah, it's a halachic work, it's a collection of halachot. So if the Rambam report Maybe I didn't put a recipe in the book, right? You know, how to make hamantashen. So they would be surprised. I mean, even if the hamantashen would be good hamantashen, and even if the recipe of the hamantashen would come from some ancient and respectable culinary source, he would still say, why does the Rambam put it there? So the fact that this comes from the Yerushalmi, that we're about to quote comes from the Yerushalmi, does not explain to us why the Rambam put it in his book. Because the book that the Rambam wrote is a book of Halacha. And the Yerushalmi is not, strictly speaking, only a book of Halachot. And therefore, the problematic nature of this material changes when it appears in the Rambam. And therefore, we're trying to understand, like, why the Rambam would put this in his book. And what does this halacha say? At least part of it. Kol sifri ha-nevi'im kol ha-ksuvim ha-sidim libotel emes Mashiach chutz mi-nevi'as Esther. The first statement he says is about the books of the nevi'im and the ksuvim. Without belaboring the point, the books of the nevi'im and ksuvim, the Tanakh, excluding the Chumash, are all books that are related to prophecy. And either they are the words of the prophet whilst prophesying, or they may be books written by prophets, or they're not prophecy. As an example, the book of Mishlei. The book of Mishlei, Proverbs, is a book that was written by a great prophet, although he was perhaps not prophesying when he wrote the book of Mishlei. This is a distinction from the book of Ben Sira. Like the book of Ben Sira, which is quoted by Chazal in the end of Masechet Sanhedrin, enough time so that they obviously read the book of Ben Sira by heart. The book of Ben Sira, which is also a book of Proverbs, is not included in the Tanakh, not because it is not a good book or it doesn't have interesting material or important ethical precepts, but because it is not written by a prophet. So that when the Rambam says all the books of the Vedic Sufi, it means prophecy. What's going to happen to prophecy? And he says, Akidim Libotel, Emes Mashiach. He says, when the Mashiach comes, they will become Bata. And of course, the problem is to define this word Bata. Bata, what's the try? What's the word Bata meaning? How would you translate it to English? Akidim Libotel. Nullified, that's good. I like that. Because whatever somebody says nullified, I can always disagree. Or, let me say this. How do you nullify a book? And what does exactly have to be nullified in it? For example, you take the book of Yirmiyahu. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but the book of Yirmiyahu is not that directing us to do anything. It's not as though we have a contract with Yirmiyahu about something. How would we nullify? How would we go about nullifying the book of Yirmiyahu? I don't know. I haven't got the slightest idea, but I think that perhaps a better translation, of the word Bittul, would be more like Bittul in the idea of Bittul Chometz. Like, we know that we have the capacity to disengage or to dissociate our bias from something, to say that it's not any longer ours. I can make something hefka. By thinking it hefka. I mean, we don't do that on Pesach because Chazal didn't trust us. You know, the old Gluska Yofa syndrome. Right? Chazal didn't trust that if we have chometz lying around in our house and we say, poof, you're better, that we would do it with a full heart. That we wouldn't think at the same time, maybe the chozot, I eat it after Pesach. You know, Chazal didn't trust. So Chazal said, better off get rid of it. You know, really get rid of it. Really make it, destroy it. So then the ownership problem doesn't exist. And I sell it. I mean, that was an innovative kind of bitter. But the basic idea of bitter is that it's not connected. There's no bias. There's no strong relationship between it and you. Intellectually, it can also be bias. Is when the Vilna Ksuvim, the Vilna Ksuvim which were written at the time of idolatry and the denial of obligation by the Jewish people, which led up to the Churban Beis HaMikdash. So in as far as I still live in that world, in the world that is created by that denial, the denial of Torah and the denial of mitzvahs and idolatry. So the relevance of the Nevi'im and Ksuvim is overwhelming. It's powerful, as we know that, you know, that when you think about the Churban Beis HaMikdash, it's not just about what was, but it's about what is. And that's the kesher to the Nevi'im and Ksuvim. But if the Emes of Mashiach are what is described in the Shemone Esrei, which is the way the Rambam understands it, Malchus, the Rebbe Shimon Gregorius, the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, that the Rambam thinks in terms of the end of history, of the Ramban. The Ramban sees the Emes of Mashiach as being the end of history, the time after which there will be no change. Therefore, the relevance of the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, one could say, becomes less intimate. It's no longer talking about me. It doesn't mean that the Nevi'im and Ksuvim won't be there, and they won't learn them, and that there are no lessons, but that the intimacy that exists before the Emes of Mashiach between us and the books of the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, that intimacy, the Rambam says, will no longer be there. That's called bitter. On the other hand, there's one exception. And the one exception is Chutz Migas Esther. And Migas Esther is not like that. Migas Esther won't be bought out. But Migas Esther is going to be Kaya. If Migas Esther is going to be Kaya, so what does that mean? It means that there's a special relevance that Migas Esther has even in the days of the Mashiach. It's before the days of the Mashiach, Migas Esther has a certain general relevance, which is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will protect the Bnei Yisrael against anti-Semites, against oppression, against whatever. But that's a generally relevant notion that is important throughout all of history. But in the time of the Mashiach, that notion becomes irrelevant, because the Malchus of the Mashiach will be recognized by all the nations of the world. The Gaza in Peres, as the Rambam says, means that the Jews and the non-Jews will be able to live in peace and harmony. The non-Jews will recognize the superiority of Torah on a certain level, on some level or other, and everything will be without any Shivan Malchus. So what then will Esther perform? So it won't be anti-Semitism. So what's the key of the girl of Esther? What's the key that's going to exist for the girl of Esther at the time of the Emes of Mashiach? I mean, now I understand the real Ksuvim are not going to meet anymore. What will the content, what will be relevant of the girl of Esther in the Emes of Mashiach? So the Rambam then goes on and says one more thing. But it's kayemus, not as a kayemus, kechamisha chum shel Torah, kechamisha chum shel Torah, shel ha'apah, she'enon b'teilin le'olam. It'll be like Torah shebechsav and Torah shebechsav. And we know that the Megillas Esther is like Torah shebechsav and Torah shebechsav, because the Megilla of the Megillas Esther contains the mitzvahs of Purim. And the mitzvahs of Purim have an infrastructure which is Torah shebechsav. So that in that way there is a Torah to the Gila Esther. So it's interesting that the Chazal developed this idea of Kabbalah Satorah at the time of Purim, but the Kabbalah Satorah we usually think in terms of, the fact that there was a hidden, God was hidden, and they had to nevertheless accept the Medor Rabbi Leraisa to place at that time. That's how we usually think about it. But according to this Rambam, the Kabbalah Satorah of Purim was the Kabbalah of Torah of Purim. And the Torah of Purim is called the Gilas Esther. The Torah of Purim contains Torah Shel Ksav, which has mitzvahs, and naturally Torah Shel Ha'apah, which appear as part of a Masechta in the Bavli, right? The Masechta of the Gila. It's part of, it's the Torah Shel Ha'apah of Purim. So, if all this is true, what is it that Megillas Esther has to offer us in the Emes of Mashiach? I mean, what is it? What's the lesson that Megillas Esther is going to be teaching us in the Emes of Mashiach, which is so critical? So the answer must be the Ratzui L'Yoy V'Chof. The lesson that Megillas Esther offers in the Emes of Mashiach, the lesson that Megillas Esther offers is that Malchus is difficult, that kingship is problematic. Even a kingship which is universally claimed, even a kingship which is accepted by the non-Jews of the world as the kingship of Mordechai was, even a kingship which is Derech Tov and Shalom, the Tov and Shalom of critical ingredients, even such a kingship may be problematic. And the problematic nature of that kingship is ultimately expressed by Ratzu L'Rov Echov. That there are even possibilities, and you imagine that in the Mos of Mashiach there could be political parties. And people who are happy about the situation and people who are less happy about the situation. And that's the Ratzu L'Rov Echov. And the mitzvah which comes to deny or to overwhelm or to overcome the problem of Malchus is Mishloach Menos Ish L'Rov Echov. Because we understand that even though the Maharal already pointed out to us, you know that there's a halacha, the halacha says that when you give, when you daven, you should get stuck. You should get stuck. Of course, so we have a minhag that in shul usually there's a pushke, and people are putting money before daven. There's even, you know, people are willing, they're even willing to put up with the fact that come to them, come to shul, while you're davening and disturb the davener and give them money, because of the halacha that you should give money before you daven. And the advantage, of course, to giving the money to a kaptzan, or to giving money to a pushker, is that if you give money to a kaptzan, you've actually done the mitzvah. And you've actually done the mitzvah of stock. Whereas when you give the money to a pushker, you didn't give the mitzvah of stock. What you did was put some money in escrow, which later on the gabbai will give out to the adhim, but you didn't do the mitzvah yet. So the Maharal and the Sirat Stoker explains that this is not quite true. That in fact, the Maharal says that the mitzvah of Stoker has two parts to it. Of course, Stoker is giving money to a poor person, that's true. He says, but there's another aspect to the mitzvah of Stoker, and that is the ability to remove the gashmius from yourself. The ability to give up something that you have. He says the ability to give up things that you have is a spiritualizing experience. It changes your attitude about what is more important and what is less important. So the Maharal says, obviously, if you give money, you put money in the pushkin before you daven, so then you're doing something which should enhance your ability to daven. Not only the mitzvah of actually giving have to be considered from time to time. As we spend time training ourselves, well, you have to get stuck there, you have to do chesed, you have to help out people who can't help themselves, and that's true. You do have to do that, and I have no interest in changing any perception on that level. But you have to also understand that friendship, that relationships that exist, have to also be supported and developed. And if they're not supported and developed, they also tend to fall away. And suddenly you find that people who are close or together at some point in time become estranged and far away, as our ideas change, as our habits perhaps change. And therefore, we have to make an effort, to retain the closeness that exists between ourselves and our friends, and that's Mishloach Menos Ish L'Rov Echov. And that's the antidote to the Rov Echov. That's the antidote to the Rov Echov. That's the antidote to the problem, to the intrinsic issues of Malchus, which will once again come up at the time of the Mos of Mashiach. So that the holiday of Purim is a holiday that will remain, and the Sefer Megillas Esther will remain, because it presents us with a model for living in good times, and not, as Levin and Ksuvim emphasize, why it is that we are living in bad times. And so Sefer Zichronos, the word Zichronot in Hebrew, is not about remembering, but it's about the active result of remembering. It's about if you remember, then what has to be done? And at the time of Amalek, remembering Amalek had implications. And those implications are called mitzvahs. That's what they are. And the mitzvah is ongoing through history because the mitzvah attacks a problem. And therefore, the zikayon of Amalek, people say, well, what do you do today that there's no Amalek? There's not. What Amalek is, the mitzvah is to remember and to be ready. To be ready to deal with the issue when it comes up. And that readiness is something that determines the Jewish personality, whether or not we actively engage with Amalek, whether we actively engage with Amalek or not. Similarly, it's called the Sefer HaZikayon, a Sefer Zichronot, in the beginning of the sixth parak of Megillah, of Megillas Esther, because then it's turning into a mitzvah. That's when the memory is becoming our memory. As long as there's a memory of Achashverosh, it is just Divrei Hayomim. Divrei Hayomim means, what do you do with it? I don't know what to do with it. And that's what Achashverosh said. And Achashverosh said, well, what do we do with this memory? How do we treat it? How do we act upon it? How do we react to it? And here's Haman. Maybe Haman knows what we should do. But the zichronot of Amalek and the zichronot of Purim have to do with the memory being transformed into the mitzvah in order that the memory should create an active goal or create a desire on our part that history should not repeat itself as history may have been in the past. So that the hero of Megillas Esther is mortified. The heroic act that he participated in was Malchus. He provides us with a model of the kind of Malchus which will, in Yitzhak Hashem, be known in the Yemos HaMashiach, which is when the Malchus of Klal Yisrael is accepted by the Jews and the non-Jews alike, not politically, but significantly, as a significant factor. The Malchus of Am Yisrael is accepted, the Shibud Golulos comes to an end, the political difficulties and strife are no longer. And in the time of Malchus, the Malchus of the ultimate Malchus, which is patterned on the Malchus of Mordechai, the most important component is Megillas Esther, remembering what's written in Megillas Esther. The Torah Shemichzav of the story and the Torah Shemichzav of the mitzvahs, especially the mitzvahs of